So call the chaplain. One of the things that we really stand for in our work, if you will, is that the work of religio-cultural competence should not be relegated to the chaplaincy or the pastoral care department. That whatever we can do to train medical practitioners and those who have contact with patients around effective ways of interacting and finding information increases that patient satisfaction and increases the reputation of the hospital. So that everything is not, if you think back to the trigger topics, every place where religion and belief and healthcare intersect does not have to do with end of life. And that there are a variety of effective ways to include the chaplain and or the pastoral care department in the ongoing health of practitioners, of patients. And again, since the last presentation, I've got no relationships to disclose. So as I said, 84% of U.S. citizens, U.S. residents, self-identify as religious. Now what's interesting about that is that 78% of U.S. residents identify with some form of Christianity. But as you further break down the denominations within Christianity, you have some denominations that actually experience being a minority tradition within a largely Christian country. Traditions that in some instances are not considered Christian or not recognized by other Christians. 41% of patients could think of at least one time when their religious beliefs influenced a healthcare decision that they made. And not just decisions that they made for themselves, but decisions that they made on behalf of their loved ones. 41% of patients in another study that actually happened, that came out in 2011, of inpatients desired a discussion of religious and spiritual concerns. And I think we really need to clarify for practitioners that we're not talking about doctors having to go to divinity school or nurses having to do, you know, internships in monasteries or anything like that. We really are talking about what finding out information that aids the treatment experience for patients. The Joint Commission has standards that were established this year that are included in the new standards for accreditation, where addressing patients' emotional and spiritual needs increases overall patient satisfaction. So some of the ways that chaplains operate within healthcare settings. They can be consulted with, or they serve as consultants. They are advisors to patients and families, and they can often act as a mediator between the medical staff and patients and families. One of the things that Dr. Padilla and I spoke about before this session is that you were telling me about an instance where imams in a particular community really felt like they were being co-opted. Because when they were called to assist or consult, they were basically called by healthcare practitioners to have their ends met. So, you know, you call the imam in and not really fully explain the situation, and please go convince that woman that she needs this surgery. Am I recreating that accurately? And so that, and if you can imagine that that is not an experience unique to imams, but it is certainly an experience that people who are serving in the role of chaplains and or within pastoral care are often called on as this device to make something happen, as opposed to the experience of finding out, here is the medical situation, can you please assist us in knowing what are the obstacles or what do patients need to know from their religious beliefs, so that we can merge these two things and hopefully have a positive health outcome. Assessment. Conducting more detailed spiritual assessments to address religious concerns. So often there may be a question on an intake form that asks the person, are you religious? You know, kind of, you know, another version of that is, do you have good religion? That kind of thing, as opposed to real open-ended questions that allow patients to talk about what it is that's important to them. Because, you know, as I said earlier, when people come to seek health care, it can be a terrifying experience. And simply because you do, if you're talking about family practice, because you ask a couple of questions at the beginning, a year later, has anything changed? again, the fluidity of religiosity and religious experience, and where something may not have been a concern a year ago, now it's critical that I have a doctor of the same sex. So checking in. Support. The chaplain can serve as the patient's advocate and provide emotional support, but often can provide emotional support to the staff as well. Because again, the staff are more than likely, with 84% of people in the country identifying as religious, they are going to need support as well. And that connection is not always made. The chaplain can also be a source of educating, so the person who can actually serve as a cultural and religious resource for staff. But on the slide I showed you before with all the different denominations, chaplains do not know everything about every tradition, and they have some of the same limitations that any one of us would. So sometimes I think we make unrealistic expectations on behalf of what the chaplain can actually provide and what could we provide for ourselves in kind. And perform community outreach. So another thing to consider about effectively using chaplains or some of the work that they do is if you have a community of people who have a religious tradition and you don't happen to have someone on staff, if you do have a chaplain, they can provide outreach to find reliable people within that community that can come in and consult. And there is a distinction between someone who is trained as a chaplain and someone who is a religious leader with good intent. And there is a particular kind of training that people can go through in regard to being a chaplain. So a couple of case studies. 62-year-old male patient was scheduled for cardiac surgery. The staff informed him that he'd have to remove his yarmulke before going to the operating room. This particular patient refused, saying that his religious beliefs as an Orthodox Jew forbade him from removing his skull cap. He said he would forego surgery rather than uncover his head. The surgeon contacted the rabbi on call, who visited the patient, who listened to him, listened to his concerns, and then reassured the patient that a surgical bonnet would still meet the requirements of Jewish law, and they were able to go ahead with the surgery. But rather than, again, try and convince this man that his concerns were inappropriate or not worthwhile, they were actually able to access the chaplains within for something like surgery, not death. So broadening that idea of where are the places where you can use chaplains and pastoral care. The Joint Commission has requirements that the hospital respects the patient's cultural and personal values, beliefs, and preferences, that the hospital accommodates the patient's right to religious and other spiritual services. And this goes to the point that Dr. Padella was talking about before in terms of a room where people can pray. And often if you think about a hospital, they have a chapel. But there's not necessarily what we call, particularly in our workplace work and some of our healthcare work as well, a quiet room, a serenity room, a meditation room, something that allows for people, even non-religious people, to actually access during very trying times. And we have recommendations on how the room should be and what should be in it and all of that kind of stuff. The hospital provides interdisciplinary collaborative care, treatment, and services. And religion is a part of that. But it's often left out of that interdisciplinary part. It's relegated to that office down the hall where all the chaplains huddle together, and that's where religion takes place. That's who takes care of that. But there's more work that could be done. It recommends that practitioners consult a professional chaplain if available, because every healthcare institution does not have a chaplaincy program or even a pastoral care department, to complete a spiritual assessment, which is why it's so critical that medical staff know how to do this as well. The chaplain may have screening questions to identify religious practices, relaxation techniques, and other coping resources that influence care. So some of the barriers between really working with chaplains effectively: the healthcare team doesn't recognize the patient's need for a chaplain. No one's dying, so we don't need a chaplain. Lack of familiarity with existing pastoral resources. So it's very often the case that we do presentations and people will say to us, we don't know if pastoral care actually provides what you're talking about. And no one has actually checked. Because pretty much they're waiting for pastors. Again, nobody's dying. Nobody's screaming in the hallway. We don't need pastoral care just yet. Concerned the chaplains will interfere with care. So that, remember, chaplains are a resource for patients and patients' advocates, and often. So there's sometimes a concern that if you call the chaplain, they're going to get on the side of the patient and be more of a problem for me in terms of just using, you know, getting this protocol initiated, as opposed to how do I partner with the chaplain or the pastoral care to actually bring about a positive health outcome. And then insufficient pastoral care staffing. There simply are not enough chaplains and pastoral care departments in healthcare institutions broadly defined. So often you've got, in one hospital that I know of, there literally are three people. There's a Catholic priest, a rabbi, and an imam. And that's it. And so the Catholic priest is actually expected to, they're all kind of like, they've all got like their area. Do you know what I mean? And with the religiosity and the diversity that exists both within the country, but what could exist in any kind of community, no one can really afford to be a solo act. Better practices for pastoral care. Train staff to routinely conduct spiritual assessments. Provide healthcare practitioners with information on available pastoral care resources. So even if you don't have it built within your hospital environment or your healthcare setting, how close is it? Who can you call? Is there a training program? What's nearby? Educate healthcare practitioners on using chaplains as a resource beyond end-of-life issues. So educating them about the trigger topics and educating medical staff about the trigger topics. Like, you may have something come up that you think has nothing to do with religion. Nobody's asked, and it has everything to do with religion. And then encourage open communication and collaboration between pastoral care and healthcare practitioners. They really are a resource to be accessed within the healthcare institution. So those are the slides, so I guess I'll sit down for quick. And then just one other thing, just a reminder that we are going to raffle off one of the copies of the medical manual at the end of the session, so if you want to put your card in there, please do that, because if one person has their card in there and your card's not in there, then they get the book.
Thank you very much.
That should be the way that goes.
Thanks so much, both of you. We have lots of time for questions now. We have some from the audience. No, please.
Yeah, I actually have a nursing background myself, and I kind of really related to what you were saying about the spiritual assessment and the checklist offered. One question is very awkwardly worded, and patients don't really know how to answer, and you don't really know how to ask it. Can you give some examples of like an open-ended question that, is it too open and wrong? You know, the initial assessment when a patient is in it,
can you all hear me from here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So one of the things that we recommend is asking a question like, what gives you hope or strength? Mm-hmm. Are there members of your community that you would like us to call or provide strength for you or provide comfort for you? So they're open-ended questions that allow people to really talk a little bit about what it is that they need. And then you can always, and I know time is always an issue, but you can actually make note of any follow-up questions. Who is that person? What's the phone number? Is there an email address? That kind of thing. Because again, it's broadening the idea of when religious issues come up. So often we're not necessarily, the only time that the relatedness between that question is if the person goes into cardiac arrest or if the person needs DNR, as opposed to what are the variety of ways within a person's healthcare experience that religion might come up, and if it does, who should we call? How can we support you? How can we move this forward?
And one of the things that we mentioned is trying to say, are there ways, and nurses do this a lot better than the physicians, but are there ways that can make this experience feel more comfortable? Are there things that you'd like me to get for you? So they might say, okay, well, you know, this cross in the middle of my room might not do it for me. Can you move that?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, certain things like that, that have nothing to do, I mean, has to do with religion, but you want to, if you don't ask that, that has nothing to do with imam, nothing to do with prayer rug, it's just that. That's just kind of every morning I look at that, that's a little.
I have a question related to that, I think. In the emergency room, how much opportunity do you have to be sensitive to religious? It depends on the patient, of course, and the condition, but generally speaking.
Well, we hope they're not boarding there for a long time. But that's a national crisis, right? We have boarding in the ED.
Yeah.
So I think that in the ED, you know, people come with the expectation that they're even more vulnerable, right? And so it's just all about, you know, when we talk to residents, when I spend time with them, it's like, you know, just having, you know, it's just open-ended questions, but being, okay, well, is there things that I can do? Is there something going on here that I need to know about, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see this dynamic in the family is a little weird. Is there someone else you need to ask? Can I, you know, so, I mean, you can't get consent for a lot of, you know, I'm putting it in your mind, I'm going to put it in mind. But certain things should make you attuned to pick up. There's something other dynamic going on here. Maybe I need to step out of the room. Maybe someone else is called. I mean, we generally, we do now, I deal with, you know, brain death and stuff in the ED and early resuscitation. But aside from that, a lot of these are just about making someone feel at ease, that they can bring something up to you,
mm-hmm.
right? And so letting them know that if you need to tell me something,
Mm-hmm. And I think the other point about the, because I'm not a doctor, but the whole idea of the different steps that you go through before you actually see a clinician. So the people who are doing intake, what can they find out so that by the time the chart actually gets to the nurse who's going to do the pre-screening,
mm-hmm.
that you already have some information.
Mm-hmm.
And often it's a conversation of, you know, there are a lot of different conversations that happen, but cultural, kind of like cultural awareness or cultural factors are not necessarily woven into that.
Another question?
Well,
yes.
I just wanted just to say there's two mnemonic devices. There's the FICA tool, FICA,
mm-hmm.
that allows, and I wouldn't, that I don't necessarily like that one the best, but it's got great questions that you can modify and put in your own words.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also ACE, I think it's Spirit,
mm-hmm.
which is another mnemonic tool that
right.
lets you address different aspects of a spiritual history from a more clinical sort
mm-hmm.
of perspective.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have FICA in the book, and it really is necessary, though, to do the work around how would you ask the question.
Yes.
Because when we do trainings, it's very, you know, we ask people to create open-ended questions, and everybody's kind of there like this for a little while. But at least the FICA and the Spirit allow you a place to start,
mm-hmm.
and it is practice.
Yeah. So, and then to my actual question, when both of you are interacting with, I'm a former medical school faculty member who taught courses in spirituality, communications, geriatrics, diversity. Basically, the medical students hated it. I taught it. you know, it was a good day, but they were trying to set me on fire. But obviously, tongue in cheek. But have you guys come across any unintended consequences from the work that you do? Because we always talk about, you know, when we're teaching these things,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the two case studies that come to mind, the two students that come to mind is, I had one student who, you know, as part of their medical education, I had them shadow chaplain. They had to do 6 hours, no white coat, no stethoscope. They weren't allowed to say, you know, they just followed the chaplain around. They got to learn about open-ended questions. They got to see how this other thing took place, and they rated their reflective journal. You know, it's great to know that there's somebody out there who's, you know, whose job it is to listen to the patient. And I went,
right.
not the message, not the learning objective that I set forth. And then, you know, and then the opposite side of that coin where I'm teaching spiritual history taking, I'm telling them, use the FICA tool, do these sorts of things, figure stuff out, and the student writes in his reflective journal, I did not ask this patient about their spiritual history because I deemed it too personal. I then proceeded to do the anal exam. And again, I go, ask me my spiritual history 3 times over.
Right.
Because that's preferable to me then. So I just wondered if you guys have found these sort of unintended
mm-hmm.
consequences or reactions to the work that you all do and how have you all handled that?
Well, I think more than the unintended consequences is the depth of evidence that we get anecdotally as to why we need to keep doing what we're doing.
Okay.
So an example of that is we were doing a focus group. There was a doctor who did a lot of work with teen health, and she was relating a story to us of a student who had acknowledged that they were considering suicide, that the young person also acknowledged that they were an atheist, and the doctor felt that since the doctor was religious, that she didn't see how she could actually make a bridge to have a conversation with the patient because she had acknowledged herself as an atheist, that this was a difficult thing for her to do. I think the other aspect in terms of the consequence is that it's one of those areas that because it does not get covered, your program is quite an exception in that it does get covered, because in most medical education, cultural competency broadly defined, never mind talking about religion, is something that takes place one day for a couple of hours, and that's it. And you know, one of the things that we were talking about before is the expectation on behalf of healthcare practitioners to learn how to interact with people that's not a part of their training, about some of the most difficult things that you could ever speak to someone about. So I think more than anything is that when we do trainings with people, it often opens the door for them to have a little bit more comfort, but also to be able to give, I think, a little bit more respect to other aspects of cultural competence, like racial disparities, ethnic disparities, language disparities, and have them be sensitive is really not the word. We're really looking for people to be competent, not masters. But we want people to be competent in their ability to interact with people. And then if you mess something up, which you're likely to do because it happens with human beings every day, then you be responsible about it, you clean it up, you apologize, and you keep it moving.
I think that in terms of unintended consequences, you know, some of the work that I do is on physicians, right? So I'll give you a positive and negative. So I think that the fact that we are now trying to reduce the power differential between the patient and provider, whether that be through now doing more cross-cultural communication skills, cultural competency, modular cultural competency, whether it be through shared decision-making, I mean, this is a trend now in medicine, right? From this sort of trend of a power differential to like get to where they are. And I think that specifically on religion, it is this question that has come up about what about us physicians, right? So the Center of the Program of Medicine and Religion, which I'm part of, has done a series of surveys over the last 5 years around physician commitments, right? So we're not a neutral actor within this environment. So there are sometimes people seek physicians out because of their religiosity. There's sometimes a physician religion, like in conscious clauses, right, where your own beliefs interact. And so the idea that we're supposed to be totally, wholly secular and interchangeable is a fallacy. And so that allows for medical students now are doing some of their scholarship track. In the University of Chicago, we have a track where medical students are allowed to take a few electives around certain topics. And so they're now doing their scholarship track in religion and spirituality from the provider side, because they want to understand how this plays a role in their own practice. So that's a positive. The negative of that is now when you're noticed as a minority community expert. So, for example, in the Muslim community, we did a survey of Muslim physicians, and we found some of them spend time in ethics committees because they're the only Muslim in the hospital, or they're seen as the senior Muslim in the hospital. But yet they have no ethical training, they have no legal training, they might be from a different background, and all of a sudden they're supposed to be this one-size-fits-all ethical consultant for any Muslim in the patient, any Muslim in the hospital. This lets us as a community think about we need to develop these sorts of core companies for ourselves, but also you can't expect that. And at this community can't say we checked the box and had an inclusion, and we had a woman, we had a Muslim, we had a black, are we done?
Right.
Can't do that. I think that's the and then people become empowered. Now, work I do is community based participatory research. Some people are vested in being that conduit, right? And no matter what you think, so as a researcher, I might say that doesn't make sense. So, no, but I am telling you. And as much as I, as a community based researcher, I think that's you're valid. I'm not saying anything about the validity of what you're saying, but you have to assess things.
Right.
We can't just take your word for it.
Right.
People say, well, no, you're right. That, because now you put them in this position of you are the liaison to XYZ community, and all you say is truth, right? So anyway.
We call that the spokesperson syndrome. Mm-hmm. And it is exactly as you say, and one of the dangers of it is what you're talking about, but it's the other danger is the deferred responsibility that all of the other people within the institution actually relegate onto that person. And so now I don't have to do any knowledge work around addressing the needs of my Muslim patients because I'm going to call Dr. Who's he, what's it, who is, by his own declaration, the authority.
There was another question back here.
Yeah, it's been sort of answered a little bit, but I'm Megan Brady, and I am from Detroit, from Henry Ford Health System, and so I'm really glad to know about this report that I didn't know about before, and so I really appreciate your comments, both of you. I've been working on a project in our maternal child health department, so with labor and delivery and postpartum care, and we're trying to, from an organizational or departmental approach, try to figure out how we provide culturally competent care on the unit. And so a lot of my work with the nurses, so far I've just worked with the nurses, but have revolved around how do we have that conversation, because we don't want to assume anything about patients, we want to ask the patients. And we know that there are varying degrees of religiosity and adherence to different belief systems and things of that nature. So we've been teaching the LEARN model for communicating across cultures, so I just wanted to hear if there are other models we could consider. And then the other question, which I think was sort of answered, was my next step is to talk to all the providers and the physicians. So, and I've talked to physicians before, and they really kind of shrugged this off and like, wait, you know, tell you to go on your way. But what really speaks to physicians, and how do we get them on board with this? So those are kind of my two questions.
So we should talk after. Do you know Kathy Klima?
Yes.
And do you know Najat Bazzi before that?
I've heard her name so many times, and I have not yet met her.
Sure, so afterward, I can give you a card. I can give you some resources. Catherine's actually coming to Chicago to do elective with me on some work related to that area of care. But I think that, I'll ask you your second question. So I think that, as any other stakeholder, the physicians are also a community, right? So we have our own professional societies, and we also have our kind of parochial societies, and we have, you know, physician organizations that are based on religion or on ethnic affiliation. So, you know, in Detroit, we have the National American Arab Physician Organization. And you know, they're centered, actually, in Detroit. One of their houses is in Detroit. The Islamic Medical Association of North America is in Chicago. So getting buy-in at that level of, okay, well, you know, this is something that I would like to assess in terms of physicians, and I want to get people from your chapter or your association that relate to Detroit in this area, let's talk to them. There's also an institute that I know about I can share with you. So I think that's how you get buy-in. We always use a survey to researchers. You get buy-in from the community by getting some community big person to sign off. Right? That gives you initial contact, but also they've approved you, you get validity within the community. So I think, and as far as the model, I think all these models now, as a researcher, I think they're all okay. They're all okay. They're not great. You have to adapt them, and they're all, you know, there's, I mean, I think they're just trying to get the conversation going. And so whatever works for that particular environment, that community, that provider, use something. It's better than nothing, but I don't have any sort of, this is the most best one around here based on the research.
And I have to say that I don't have a best practice in terms of that either, but one of the things I would also mention is the same organizations for nurses to actually present what you've already found and from the body actually find out what else is going on.
Yeah, there was a question.
Yeah, maybe mine is a comment rather than a question. We have seen the significance and the position of religion since the beginning of human life in positive as well as negative way, in political and economic and even, you know, putting all together being embedded into our life. But now, over the last 2 decades, we have seen through empirical amount of empirical researches and now, yes, research religion or spirituality. work in the name of health or by healing. So there are tons of religious activities right now. So shall we go ahead and just customize or just cope with whatever they have at their present time? So as especially Mr. Power showed, there are lots of trigger topics. So maybe certain religion, in the way certain religion practice is conflict with others, or especially with maybe cell mechanisms or gene mechanisms. Just as people who believe you mean in their religion, which is working on their maybe the cancer prevention. But if we look at the from the point of really cancer or cell or gene work, it is not supposed to work. So, you know, UV itself is a waste product, though, as we, as a healthcare professionals, we know that, but even worse. By the same token, because a certain religion, the way certain religion work in the field of health is working, so we kind of allow them to really suggest or insist the way they want to receive from healthcare fields or a hospital or a, you know, center. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are things we have to think about it. Just as same-sex marriage is you know, what they want, so they demand, so we just accept or, of course, at the present time, yes, we respect, even though somebody drink or eat a high saturated fat, we respect them. However, everything has a choose part. Especially the assumptions or expectation of a religion is what? We all are looking for creator. Actually, creator of light. Or, you know, the origin, the source of light. So then, that includes our living organism as well as the way cell work or gene work. That we as healthcare professionals, at least we have to think about it. What is a really true aspect as far as we talk about the reason of our spirituality? Especially when you look at the gene now, especially gene expression is working through the presence of a supernatural existence. That's not proven through epigenetic science. Really, there is a spirit.
I think, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I also want to be mindful of time because I know that there's at least one other person who wanted to ask a question. The only thing that I would say is that I think that it's important for those of us who are providing training for medical practitioners as well as for current practitioners to be mindful of absolutes. And so the all is something that I would be mindful of in terms of how we actually engage this topic of religiosity or religion and healthcare. There are 16% of the people in this country who do not believe in anything, self-identified by themselves. Now, we could talk about and dispute their beliefs that they actually believe in something. And we could engage in a topic like that. But in the meantime, that person is coming into the emergency room or seeking direct care or not accessing care in a particular community because they may feel on the outside of it. I think it's also important to be mindful that people practice religions. Religions don't practice themselves. And so whatever, with all of the, there are places where traditions are, you know, agree, there are places where they don't agree, but we're talking about adherence. We're talking about people who practice tradition. And I think the great responsibility, unfortunately, again, on healthcare practitioners is what is it that they can do to increase their knowledge of not the topic of the religion itself, but on the skills to interact with people when religion comes up in the variety of ways that it can.
Yeah, that's right. So we as healthcare professionals, so we have to value, we respect. That's a, you know, not the comment that I want to make. So we as healthcare professionals, given that respect and the value required in that field.
Absolutely.
But how we, because we know how things work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the question is epistemology. So I also, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I think that the question that you're asking is more about religion and science, right? So,
we are each religion has a pros and cons, kind of, not necessarily to be
I don't think about religion at all. I mean, in the sense that, so if you think about it, we're scientists, we we are trained in empirical science, we are reductionists in certain ways, we value things as true or not true based on a methodology, right? And religions might have a metaphysical manifestation of reality, and they might feel that there's some other way that you know truth, not know truth. And that conversation of religion and science has always been going on, it's, right? Millennia, right? It's always been that way. So I think that, that what you're speaking to is sometimes we spiritualize, we medicalize spiritual things. So we say this has benefit, and so we're going to call this a benefit, and we trust it to our blind randomized control trial. And sometimes we spiritualize, you know, so we take medical things, we take spiritual things and make them medicalized. And the opposite also occurs, where we take medical things and spiritualize them, right? So now prayer, right, should do this or should do that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because of epistemology. Mm-hmm. And in the end, as Mark said, people interpret religions, they give a lived tradition. But I think we should be mindful of that. We all are indoctrinated in a certain way to look at things. And if people don't come to us with that same indoctrination, how do we communicate? Right. That's all. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. You know, and I can't, so there are some people who say that I can't be your, I can't believe this, I can't do that. So I think that it's a problem with epistemology. I don't want to, I mean, that conversation that you're talking about is a large conversation, and we're just taking a piece of it.
I want to hear from this lady in the back who had a question in a while. Thank you for your patience.
No problem. I don't know, maybe I'm the only, I don't know, I might be the only health educator in the world. But I specifically came to this because my area of research interest has always been looking at the relationship between spirituality, religion, and health from a health behavior and a health education perspective. And I would just say that at the same time that you are working to educate nurses and physicians, don't forget your health education partners, because many of us, especially if we've been training, and myself in health counseling, we do know, and we have been trained in how to ask or help you ask some of those questions in an open-ended way that can actually spur discussion. It's something, it's an area where I know as a professional, as a researcher, I look for ways to get into the clinical arena. Very often, health educators, at least myself as a health educator, get shut out. Because it's like, well, you don't have the scientific background or the medical background, but yet we are trained in some cases, motivational interviewing, in health counseling, in looking at things from the perspective of health behavior theory that can help in the development of curricula for medical students, for nurses, so that we can be part of the team. I applaud both of you. I'm sorry I missed your presentation, but this is something that I think, you know, needs to be done more often, and I don't know if anybody's going to take this message back to the medical care section, but definitely.
We have health paper people on our team.
And then there's always, I'm sure there's an evaluation process. I mean, I put an evaluation in the back, but that's something to include in your evaluation, that if you found this topic of interest, to include that in your evaluations, because that's what the program committee will use for planning.
Just in practical terms, we cannot include anything on the program for which we haven't received abstracts. This is an invitation for more people to
submit abstracts. I'm just going to say that it's also an opportunity to co-sponsor sessions. For 5 years, I was actually an executive board member with the Caucus on Public Health and Faith Community. And I was actually kind of disappointed to see that they had not decided to co-sponsor this session. But I really think that, you know, there's an opportunity there, because very often we used to get abstracts that primarily deal with health promotion and health education, and we don't see these types of sessions. So there's some room there, and I'll put that on my evaluation as well. But
good.
I really do applaud.
Thank you. We're a minute or two over, so thanks everybody for coming with Frida. Stay around and talk some more if you want.